is in Bengali simple language, presenting a very venerable example which is found in the Upanishads, in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He's speaking of this soul as a bird, Bengali word paki. And of course we know within the tree of this body there are two birds. There is the Paramatma, who is the Shakshi, the witness. And then there is the Atma, also a bird, but this bird is busy. The Paramatma is serene, simply observing, but the individual soul, he's busy hopping about in the different branches of the tree of this body, tasting fruits. And the fruits, some are sukh, some are nice, sweet, they give happiness, and others give dukkha, unhappiness. So that's his business. And he has completely forgotten his eternal friend, the Paramatma. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur is addressing this bird, his soul. Keno Hari Krishna Nam Hari Bole Mano Pran Kande Na. Oh, why does my heart not weep from chanting the holy names Hare Krishna? Pati na jani kon aparadhe muke Hari Krishna nam bolo na. The bird of my heart does not know what past sinful activities it has committed to cause this inability to chant Hare Krishna properly. So the sense here is that due to being busy for so long tasting the fruits of sense gratification and suffering, sensual suffering, we have committed so many offenses. And we have lost the higher taste. We have simply been cultivating this lower taste of the senses. So until that lower taste can be given up, there's no possibility of really tasting the sweetness of the holy name, the transcendental rasa of Lord Krishna's direct association. Therefore, in that song by Lochan Das Thakur, that Vishayacharya, Se Rasa Maje Mukhe Balo Hobi Hobi. You have to give up Vishaya, sense gratification. And only then, Se Rasa Maje, only then will the actual nectar of chanting be tasted. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, taking the humble position, is lamenting that the bird of my heart does not have this taste. And therefore, when I try to chant Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, the real fruit of that chanting is not being realized. So, Baner Paki Re Dhari Raklam Ridoy Mandire Madhu Makha E Harinam Paki Re Shikhai Re Shikhe. O forest bird, I have kept something for you very carefully within the cottage of my heart, the holy name of Lord Hari, which is overflowing with pure sweet honey. O bird, you could learn the chanting of this name if you were taught. A bird is easily able to speak all names. Why then does not this bird of my heart, why then does this bird of my heart refuse to chant Hare Krishna? Oh, why does my heart not weep from chanting the holy names Hare Krishna? Oh bird, come, let us go to the spiritual world, the land of true and everlasting beauty. It is the place where the imaginary man of my mind will never again come and go on the revolving cycle of birth and death. This is that Malir Manush.
I wrote to you about that.
This is an interesting point that...
There's so many things built in there.
Yes. This is very philosophical. So there's a lot of meanings that can be derived from that. But just to put it simply, everyone has a conception of themselves, which is not the actual true self, eternal servant of Krishna. Something falling short, something imaginary. But that imaginary person, that imaginary self, is looking for ultimate happiness, ultimate satisfaction. Everyone is looking for that in life. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, this thing that you are looking for, we're all looking for, can be had if we go back home, back to Godhead. And the process is again the pure chanting of the holy name of Krishna. So what Bhaktivinoda Thakur here is saying is that whatever we're looking for in life, whatever we think will give us satisfaction, that can actually be obtained. We can actually get full satisfaction, but by this process, not by just going on in imagination, but by actually chanting the holy names purely. So, O bird, at the time of death, your body will simply be placed upon a funeral stretcher, lifted on the shoulders of four persons and carried to the cremation grounds. Alas, the cremation fire will then enter your mouth and totally consume your tongue. And when they light the body, isn't it they put the fire in the mouth first?
Yes. Is it?
Yes.
Yes. I never got that one.
Okay. Yes.
Towards the head.
So, then the tongue, this is the first thing that burns. And then there will be nothing you can do to save yourself, for at that time it is too late. You'll be unable to speak anymore. So this is his prayer. Start chanting now. Start chanting purely now. And attain this taste. Because if you let it go, let it go, let it go, then one day it will not be possible to chant anymore. So, this is introduction to the seminar. Why? Why did I select this song? Because this song is so much stressing the importance of achieving perfection in chanting Hare Krishna before the end of this life. And philosophy. Our subject of this seminar is philosophy. What is philosophy essentially about? I'd like to read to you a quotation. This is from a Frenchman, Jacques Choron. European philosophy is dominated by French and Germans. So this gentleman, Jacques Choron, has tried to express the essential concern of philosophy. So I'll read this sentence. The question of the meaning of human existence in the totality of being, this fundamental question of philosophy, gains its true and practical importance through man's total discovery of death. Now, I need to unpack this. This is a term that is used, unpacking. In philosophy, there are statements that are made that are very dense. You see, and when you hear them only once, so much can slip past you. So therefore there is the need of what they call unpacking, going back and looking at the statement carefully and understanding it point by point. So first of all, he's speaking of the fundamental question of philosophy. So philosophy, you mentioned in your class, love of knowledge. It's coming from the Greek language, philosophia, means love, and Sophia means knowledge. Interestingly enough, this word Sophia is a name from the West. Those coming from the West may have known some girl, some lady with the name Sophia. It's a common woman's name. And actually, in ancient culture, Greek culture, that part of the Mediterranean world that was predominated by Greek civilization, Sophia was a goddess. A goddess, something like the goddess Saraswati. Goddess of knowledge, goddess of learning, Sophia. So, a philosopher was a devotee of wisdom, of knowledge. So, there's actually a whole explanation of the goddess Sophia. She was in charge of the souls, which are compared to sparks. and these sparks have fallen into the darkness of this world. And Sophia was always concerned. She was always, her whole effort was try to reclaim these fallen souls, to bring them up to the light of knowledge again. This is the original sense of this word, Sophia. So it is knowledge, but it is actually knowledge that results in liberation, freedom of the soul. In the ancient world, they understood samsara, reincarnation. There was a fancy Greek word, metempsychosis. We use a Latin-based word, reincarnation, which literally means, carna means flesh. So to take on flesh again and again, to be embodied again and again. But the Greek word, metempsychosis, psyche in Greek means soul. So the idea is that the soul is moving. There's a soul that is moving from one body to another, to another, to another, to another, to another. And so as long as the soul is in this ignorance, it continues on and on. So Sophia, the original sense of this knowledge, of this word, is knowledge that releases the soul from the darkness of ignorance and from repeated birth and death. This is very ancient. Now, of course, there are men who call themselves philosophers, but they don't think in these terms at all. But going back to the original sense, this is what it means, philosophia. So philosopher, the first person in history known to have used this word, philosophy and philosopher, was Pythagoras. So Pythagoras was a mystic of the ancient Greek world, and this exactly was his teaching, that the soul should become free from birth and death. And Pythagoras, after him, there were such philosophers as Socrates and Plato, and they were on this same theme. And later, philosophy became more corrupted, and now practically means any old nonsense, of course. But this is the original sense of philosophy. So, the fundamental question of philosophy, philosophia, is, looking back at these words of Jock Choron, what does human existence mean in the totality of being? So this word being is, he renders it with a capital B. So this means something very special. And so for our understanding, we can just think of the Sanskrit word sat. We may accept that yes, that there is existence. But then one has to understand what is real existence. This existence that we are now experiencing may not be the real one. Therefore, there is so much speculation. Therefore, there is so many different philosophies. Because they're all struggling with this. What is it? Is it real? Is it not real? Why are we suffering? All these questions come up. Because there is something wrong with the present state of affairs. So, sat means existence, but furthermore means true existence. Reality. And sat means what else? There's one thing we haven't mentioned yet. Eternality. Yes. So these senses. Something is, something truly is, and something truly eternally is. Mm-hmm. So, this is the, we can derive this, these meanings from this word being with capital B. That, what does human existence mean in the totality of being? What is our place in existence, in true existence, in eternal existence? We human beings who get so caught up in day-to-day affairs, forgetting the big picture, forgetting that this material world has its beginning and its end. What is our place in it? Is there a possibility of going beyond this? So this is the fundamental question. And then he goes on to say the true and practical importance of this question. Again, our position as human beings in relationship with supreme existence, The true and practical importance of this question is apparent to a man who has discovered the totality of death. What does that mean? The totality of death. So, it's explained elsewhere by this gentleman, Jacques Choron, that no embodied creature is exempt from death. Everywhere we see, ahanya hani bhutan, you know that verse, spoken by Maharaj Yudhisthira to Yamaraj, yes. That everywhere we look, we see, at every moment, countless living entities are meeting their death. So no one is exempt. So this is one sense of the totality of death. And another sense is that it is an utter threat to our individuality. Now whether it really extinguishes our individuality, that we cannot say until we've gotten real knowledge. But at least we can say it is a threat. Because, you know, people talk about living beyond death by some sort of sentimental transference. I'll live on in my children. Sometimes you meet people like that. Well, I'm not worried about death because my son is there. And he will have his son. And in this way, the generations of my family will go on. So I'll live in that way. Or I'll live in my people. You see, they're different categories of people. You see, here we're in Tamil Nadu, so the Dravidian people, the Tamil people, you see, very much a hamkara attached to this. And I may die, but I'll live on in my Tamil brethren. So I'm just saying that because we're here. Everywhere you go, you'll find this. If you go to Bengal, the Bengalis are talking like that. If you go to different places in Europe, and the Germans will talk like that, the French will talk, everyone. This is another type of transference. Or I'll live on in history. You see, someone thinks I'll become famous by what I do and people will talk. In that way I will live on. But, so what this Jacques Charon is saying, regardless of these attempts to transfer, you as you will cease to exist. You as the you that you know yourself now, death will swallow that up. So when someone can actually confront that, can actually face this without these, you know, foolish escape hatches, transference and all of that, when someone actually faces that death is going to come for me as I am, as Suhotra Swami or Rochan Prabhu, or as we are find ourselves now, that this identity will not exist much longer. Then, for him, this question of what is the meaning of human existence in relationship to the great existence, the supreme existence, what is the meaning of it? This question becomes important. So, this is, so far, I've just been speaking in terms of the European reference of philosophy, but we find a very strong bridge between this sense of the essence of philosophy in Europe and this sense in India, in the Vedic culture of knowledge. Srila Prabhupada explained the meaning of one of the great Upanishads, Keno Upanishad. So Keno in Sanskrit means why. Srila Prabhupada said, this is the Upanishad of asking why. And Srila Prabhupada further illustrated this by citing Sri Sanatana Goswami, Ke Ami. Who am I? This is another way of asking, why do I exist? Who am I? Why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? And why am I suffering? The Tapatraya, the threefold miseries. So this is there, also as the essence, the foundation of Vedic philosophy, this question. And Sanatana Goswami, in asking these questions to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he right away discounted or what he called gramya vyavahar. There is a commonplace, or you can use the word laukika, commonplace, conventional idea of what is knowledge, which falls short of this, asking who I am, why do I exist, why am I suffering? So in this world, in this material world, there are so many so-called pundits who can reel off all kinds of facts and figures and, you know, classifications of information. Information, you see, simply information about dead matter. Last time when we were speaking in Czech Republic, Maharaj made considered a very brilliant comment. He was talking about the Indologists who study Sanskrit texts of the Vedas and so on. But as he said, they go about it the way the biologists study worms. See? As there are some fellows who study worms who become experts, who can tell you, yes, in Tamil Nadu we have 27 different kinds of worms. And he can give the names. So this may be of some you know, relative interest to someone, certain times, certain places, certain circumstances. But in answering the real question, who am I, why am I here, what is the purpose of life, why am I suffering, this type of knowledge will not help. And so if Vedic knowledge is rendered in the same way, just facts and figures, laced together with so much speculation, that also will not help. So this is gramya vyavahar, in the opinion of common people. A learned man, he is not actually learned. No, until he addresses these questions. Why, basically? Keno, why? And then science. Science is also discounted. Why is that? Because science is concerned with the question how. How things happen. It is, in other words, it's a mechanistic approach. Now, you may have a little difficulty in separating the two, why and how, but it's very evident when it comes to the study of consciousness, because consciousness is fundamental to our philosophy, and I'll be speaking of this more as the seminar goes on. Actually, everything begins with consciousness. So, in the Western world, there's a great debate about consciousness. And the division is actually between those who are concerned with why and those who are concerned with how. The why, like I just mentioned a name that doesn't mean anything to you, but he's quite big in the field. His name is David Chalmers. He's originally from Australia, but he's a professor in the United States. So he's something like a modern Western version of a Sankhya philosopher. The Sankhya philosophers, they say there are ultimately two realities, two tattvas, Purusha, Prakriti. And you can't go beyond them. So that's his position. He says, yes, there's matter, but there is also consciousness. And consciousness, he argues, we have to just accept. We can't get beyond it. It's just like if you look in the dictionary, look up the word conscious, and you'll find words like awareness, you see. This is the meaning they give, awareness or consciousness. Now go to you, look up awareness in the dictionary, and you'll find consciousness. So, just going around in a circle of words, because you can't get beyond it. So this man, Chalmers, he's a more intelligent modern philosopher, because he's saying, look, let's be honest about this. Consciousness is a fact, and we can't explain it away. So the real question then is simply, is why are we conscious? It's a fact. It's an ultimate fact. Why are we conscious? But the scientist then says, no, how are we conscious? And as he points out, then that means they get into, you know, studying the brain and the nervous system. And he says, this never explains why we are conscious, why we are aware, why we are experiencing. You talk about neurons flowing in the synapses of the brain, but that doesn't explain why you're aware. You see, we're also aware of our brain. Sometimes we get a headache. You see? So, why? Why are we aware of the brain? Why are we aware of this body? It's just like you're sitting in a car. You see? Yesterday we were riding in the bus to Sri Rangam and back. So that's, you have an experience, sitting in the seat of the bus. You look outside, you see so many things going by, so many sounds are there, people are there, you see? So now, why are we experiencing this? So if someone answers, well, you see, there's an internal combustion motor in the front of the bus, and it's turning a drive shaft, which goes to differential, and that turns the back wheels, and there's also transmission, so you can get different speeds, and there's a brake, and there's a steering wheel. And so that doesn't explain why we're having this experience going down the road in the bus. You see? And that's the scientific bias, you see? They always go to this how question, how mechanically, how things are put together. So they confuse structure with knowledge or consciousness. They always do this. You see? Why are we conscious? Well, there's this brain. It has so many, you see, they talk about the structures of the brain. So many nerves are there. So very complicated. But you can make a machine as complicated as you want. You see? You can build something, make it as complicated as you want. Put so many things in there. So many wires and fuses and printed circuits and this and that and this, but it doesn't add up to consciousness. It doesn't add up to awareness. So Chalmers, he's written a book and several brilliant papers in which he points out that they're always making this mistake. And actually, he's done a good service because he's really gotten them in a corner. They try to. He's really pointed, and they, you know, so they're embarrassed now. And they've resorted. I read recently one reply to Chalmers from some scientific person, and he says, "Well, Chalmers, he has something to say now, but wait 20 years. It's okay. In 20 years in our study of neurophysics, we'll have explained consciousness, and then he'll be out of a job. These philosophers, you see, because." There's also a great tension between philosophy and science in the modern world. Scientists don't like philosophers. They actually don't like philosophers. It used to be that science came out of, you know, scientists were first trained in philosophy, but not anymore. One scientist, biologist in London, he very proudly said in his book that nowadays, you see, a quantum physicist, this is a scientist in one of the leading edge fields of physics, a quantum physicist, he knows as much about philosophy as a car mechanic. And he was saying this very proudly. You see? We're very practical people. We don't care for philosophy. Our intellectual life will be more concerned with things like science fiction. You see? In other words, we nurture our thinking, our, you know, intellectual life by reading science fiction rather than reading philosophy. They don't like philosophers. Why? Because philosophers are always asking this why question. The scientists are very busy making things, you see, at work with the house, making machinery and technology and all, and the philosophers ask, but why? What's the point of it? And that makes the scientists are very angry. And so now their only reply to this Mr. Chalmers is, just wait 20 years and then we'll put you out of job. We won't have any need for these philosophers anymore. We'll have explained everything. So they've been saying this for a good long time. Srila Prabhupada said, this is post-dated check. Don't believe them. So, yes, get back to the point. Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, my point is that science is therefore discounted because it is only concerned with how. So, the typical mundane information and even science, this falls short of the real concern of philosophy. So, why? Why am I here? Why am I conscious? Who am I? Why am I suffering? These are the concerns of philosophy. Now, I thought, so this is just establishing the basis, the foundation. And I thought today, before going further, that I should talk about my philosophy. Because I'm giving a seminar on philosophy, and everyone who speaks about philosophy must have a philosophy too. And it's very important to find what that is. So then you'll be able to understand what angle this person is presenting his teaching from. So, yes, my philosophy is Bhagavata philosophy, but in the Bhagavata there are some 18,000 shlokas. So I want to focus on one particular shloka, which I think is very relevant to what we're doing here today, and nicely expresses my own direction of presentation. And this is from the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 13, verse 44. I'll read that here. Yan manyase dhruvam lokam adhruvam vana shobhayam sarvata nahi sochaste sneha anyatam mohajat. And this is spoken by Narada Muni to Maharaj Yudhisthira. And he is saying that you may consider what is under discussion here in this shloka is that, yeah, there are different philosophical points of view. But let's get down to the one common platform of all different philosophies. So you may consider the soul to be eternal, or you may think that the self is simply this perishable body. Or you may think all is one, as the Mayavadis do. Or you may think, as the Sankhya philosophers do, all is two. As I explained, there is matter and there is spirit, and somehow or other, inexplicably, they are combined. So Narada Muni is saying, you may have any of these different points of view, but the conclusion, there is one common conclusion to all of these. And that is that feelings of separation, feelings of lamentation for something that is lost, that is illusion. So the one common conclusion to all is, in other words, vairagya, renunciation, detachment. If we, as we do in our philosophy, accept that the soul is eternal, so then that means what we are experiencing in this material world is temporary. So why should the eternal soul become attached to anything that's temporary? If we become attached, we are being foolish. That is our illusion. Now, a materialist, he may say, I don't believe in soul. I believe only in this body. So, sir, you're a good materialist, so you accept that this body is temporary. Yes, I do. So that means whatever you're attached to, that has to end. Yes, that is right. So again, it's the same conclusion. See? Don't become entangled in things. Therefore, Buddhism, we mentioned Buddhism. Buddhism is like this. Buddhism, in their own language, the Pali language, anatta, which is apabhramsa of Sanskrit, anatma, anatta. So there's no soul in Buddhism. There is only this body, and Srila Prabhupada said by their meditation, they're trying to break down this body, conceiving of this body as ultimately atoms. and in this way discarding it. So it's the same thing. Be detached. Don't become entangled in anything. And for Mayavadi philosophers who say all is one, the same conclusion. Detachment. And Sankhya philosophers also. So, but then as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we must consider useful attachment. This is called what? Yukta Vairagya. That which is useful in Krishna's service. So, therefore we come ultimately to distinguishing between different philosophies, accepting that in the initial phase, all the conclusion of all is that one should not become entangled in the things of this world. But furthermore, the things of this world are given by Krishna for his service. So this is a further step of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta. And so that's where these other philosophies fall short. But still, in establishing the basis, the general principle of Vairagya, we can refer to the insights of other philosophies, as Narada Muni has. Lord Krishna does the same thing to Arjuna in the Gita. He says, even if you don't think there is a soul, still you should not lament. So, in the purpose of, as I'm saying, this is my philosophy, in the purpose of this seminar, we'll be looking at other philosophies, especially from this consideration of detachment, Vairagya, which is useful. So, for example, there are philosophies of evolution. There is the famous Darwin idea of evolution. And then in our Bhagavata philosophy, we have an explanation of evolution also. But the Bhagavata philosophy includes the soul, that actually the soul is evolving from lower stages of consciousness to higher stages of consciousness. And this is giving a facility for the soul to, in this human form of life, achieve perfection, to be released, liberated from matter altogether. So that is entirely missing from the Darwinian philosophy of evolution. Darwin was only concerned with the body. Again, consciousness being equivalent to the structures of the brain and so on. So, Darwin, in his autobiography, he wrote this. Let's hear. Sri Darwin Uvacha. Believing, as I do, that man, in the distant future, will be a far more perfect creature than he now is, it is an intolerable thought that he and all other sentient beings are doomed to complete annihilation after such long-continued progress. So he himself was facing, you see, the great drawback of his own teaching, that because everything is matter, and again, everything material must be annihilated. Therefore, this whole complicated scenario that he dreamed up of Darwinian evolution ends in nothing. You see, man will evolve, as you may have seen, speaking of science fiction, so there's these futuristic stories and films also, you see the man of the future with a big bloated head and a skinny body. And he's traveling from planet to planet very easily and freely in futuristic spaceships and all of that. But at some point in the future, inevitably, since everything material must perish, so even this evolved man must cease to exist, along with all other sentient creatures. And Darwin himself said, this thought is intolerable. But Charlie, that is the consequence of your philosophy. So, what then, which version from the point of view of Vairagya is more sensible? You see? The Bhagavad explanation of evolution says that it is the eternal soul that is evolving. And so when we consider this philosophy of evolution, we see soul moving from body to body. So again, let that soul become detached from the body. Let that soul achieve spiritual perfection. Go back home, back to Godhead. So this is answering for Charles's problem very nicely. But if this philosophy is not there, then we come to a paradox. Material philosophies end in paradoxes. You see. So this is a good rule of measure. The principle of vairagya, renunciation, useful, yukta vairagya. That renunciation which is useful for actually freeing the soul from material existence. So this is, I'm explaining to you, this is a personal measure I use and when I'm having to confront different ideas, different philosophies. This is how I do it. Like I said, with evolution, one can go about arguing with evolutionists in a scientific way, like Dhrutakarma has done, Dhrutakarma Prabhu has done, and the Sadaputra Prabhu in their book. But I'm not very much trained. I have some college background in, you know, some scientific studies, but not very much. I can't consider myself an expert in that field. But I was trained by Srila Prabhupada. You're all being trained in this philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So I find it more useful to use this question of renunciation as the measure. The fulfillment of the soul's innate longing for liberation from this material existence. We see all philosophies come to the conclusion that there is no point in becoming entangled in this material world. But then we have to see whether their conclusion is actually useful. You see, if the conclusion is simply nihilism, that there is nothing, that everything will dissolve and there is nothing left, that is not at all hopeful. So this is the measure. So we're speaking of my philosophy. I'll be as the course proceeds, referring to different philosophies, different ideas, some of them very speculative. And you may wonder, what is the necessity of learning all this? So we'll always try to come to this conclusion. What is actually useful? What is actually suitable for the liberation of the soul from matter, which is, we've already established in the beginning, that is the main concern of philosophy. The main concern is this question. What is the meaning of human existence in terms of the greater existence, especially when we are faced with death? With an obstacle. And that is ajnana, that is ignorance. We want to know what is the meaning of life. We want to know what is the purpose of this human life. Why am I here? Why am I suffering? So what is stopping us from having the answers to these questions? And that is our own ignorance. So now this brings up different approaches. And from Srila Prabhupada we learn that there are basically two. Only two approaches to the truth. One is avaroha and one is aroha. So avaroha means coming down. Coming down from superior authority, from Krishna, from Lord Brahma, Guru Parampara, on downward. And avaroha means because it is coming down, the absolute truth coming down from superior authority. Therefore, there is need for us to qualify ourselves to receive that tattva, that absolute truth. And this is the sense of the word darshan. Darshan in Sanskrit means simply vision, to see something. But moreover, it means proper understanding, right understanding. Therefore, we have these Vedanta darshans. Different sampradayas have given different darshans. In this sampradaya, achincha beda beda tattva. And this is held to be the proper understanding. So one must qualify himself, just like Lord Brahma, in order to receive the Vedic knowledge from Lord Krishna. Even though he is Krishna's direct son, we were mentioning this morning. So born from Padmanabha, the lotus navel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna's direct son. Lord Brahma is the original Brahmana. Now many of the Brahmana class in India are thinking that it is by birth alone that qualifies me as a Brahmana. But we see that is not true of Lord Brahma himself. All Brahmanas, they trace their gotra ultimately to Brahmadev. For one to be a Brahmana, one's gotra, one's family line must somehow get back to Brahma. But Brahma was not simply born and end of story. He had to qualify himself. So we see in the Srimad Bhagavatam that as Prabhupada says, after performing a experiment, a scientific experiment, climbing down the lotus flower to try to find the origin of the lotus, he failed, but he heard the words tapa, tapa, and so then he went back up and sat down in meditation, performed austerities and meditation for one whole day of his life, which is equivalent to 4,300,000,000 solar years. Very, very long time. So this is implicit in this avaroha panta, that one must qualify oneself to receive this transcendental knowledge. Transcendental meaning that which is coming from above. That's the actual meaning of transcendental. One must qualify oneself. And this way, one is blessed by the, as Krishna says in Gita, the tattva darshis, those who see the truth. This is the meaning of darshan. One gets darshan by being blessed by those who are tattva darshi. So, this entails a purification of consciousness. Compare consciousness or awareness to, Lord Chaitanya has compared it to a mirror. Chaito Darpana Marjana. The mirror has become dusty. This is a dusty atmosphere. If one does not clean glass for many days, then you know the dust accumulates on it. The mirror becomes opaque. It does no longer reflect. The glass pane becomes opaque. You can't see through it anymore. So similarly, our consciousness has become opaque, covered with the impressions of matter. And this is all we know. This body, this world around us. So consciousness must be purified. So this is part and parcel of the avaroha process. Now the aroha, ascending process, there's a different assumption. The assumption is that I, as I am now, can come to know the truth. If I do certain things, but purification is not really considered. Some technique, some word juggling or whatever, some experimentation or hypothesis, experimentation on the sensual platform or hypothesis on the mental, intellectual platform, that may be going, but the basic materials, instruments of my mind and senses as they are now, these are sufficient tools for understanding the truth. So, Srila Prabhupada dismissed this. He said, these type of fellows, they demand to see God. You say there's a God, so show him to us now. The Prabhupada said, do you have the eyes to see God? You see? God is not something cheap. So this is the consideration. This is the distinction between these two schools of basic schools of philosophy. That in one, in the avaroha, descending path, we are acknowledging that our senses, our mind, they have these defects. Four kinds of defects. They're imperfect. They're limited. They're subject to making mistakes, and therefore they are in illusion. And this must be rectified. On the other side, these defects are not taken into consideration. So, and now, in considering this approaching the truth, approaching the absolute truth, we have, according to our acharyas, and this is also acknowledged even in non-Vedic philosophical systems, we have three basic means of understanding this truth. In other words, of trying to remove this ignorance and getting at the truth. There are three basic means. So in our Sanskrit terminology, these are pratyaksha, sense perception, anumana, inference or speculation, Prabhupada used that word, and finally shabda, authoritative testimony. So I want to, at this point, having said this, I want to now pause, because I'm trying to keep everything simple, but this has already covered quite a lot of ground. I found in giving these type of seminars that you should not take anything for granted. Every simple point can be a great issue of contention in the minds of some persons. So this subject of pratyaksha, anuman and shabda is going to lead us into a whole other, at least one seminar session, if not more, because there are many, many philosophical issues attached to these three. So before going on to that, I want to just pause here and open for any questions or comments or discussion that you might have on what we've said so far. Yes, ma'am.
I have some points. You were talking about the. You were talking about how scientists, they want to see and examine the workings of the brain to try to explain consciousness. A few years ago, I happened to meet a neurosurgeon. He's an Indian man who works in London. So this man, he's working with cutting people's brains, putting them back in whatever he's doing. So anyway, he told me that actually we don't know how the brains work. It's an accepted theory that there is a discharge of current from one neuron to another, and in this way, thoughts and formed in the brain. But he says we don't actually know if that's true or not. Just a comment. On the point of my philosophy, that just reminded me shortly before I was let in through the back door of Islam and was allowed to join. I saw in a second-hand bookshop a big, thick book called My Philosophy by someone whose name I never heard, and I don't think anyone else had ever heard it, and I didn't bother to look at it. I just point of information. Does anyone else want to say anything else before I say something? More? This could lead on to... This might lead you to slap your hand to your head. It could be another whole session of the seminar. Does anyone else want to say anything?
We have many days, you see. That's why...
Any one thing you say...
like to keep it open.
Any one thing you say, we could ask a question. That would be another whole 10-day seminar.
Yes.
It's a big subject. Does anyone else want to say anything before?
It's important, you know, if that you also be thinking and considering from different angles of vision what I'm saying, and come up with questions, because this is the way we get realization. This is the way all this theory. See, I don't like to wallow around in theory myself. You know, I lose my energy too if I just feel like I'm droning on and on and on about abstract things. It becomes crystallized, it becomes concrete when you respond, when you think about what I'm saying. It's important. Yes?
You were talking about Vairagya, that if people start to argue about what's up, then you bring this Vairagya point in, but can you bring some practical example? Elaborate.
Yes, well, you see, first thing is that typically, I mean, in any culture where there is philosophy, anything passing as philosophy, you see those philosophers, those sages, those wise persons, they are celebrated for being aloof, being detached. This is something that just goes along with this type of thought. This type of thought that asks this ultimate question, why? Why are we here? What is the point of life? And this becoming detached from this world, this is respected in any... You can look at the... what is recognized as civilized cultures of the world. There's European culture. Of course, we're starting with Indian culture, but there's the culture of Europe. There's China also, that's considered a very ancient civilization. So, in all of these cultures, there is this idea of a wise man, a learned man, as being detached, aloof, dispassionate. He does not get caught up in, you know, the petty affairs of the mundane world. And for that reason, he's respected by others. Others who are caught up, you see, who are hung up in their, you see, family, little family tragedies and all these kind of things, and don't know what to do, they search out such a person who seems to be aloof and wise, and they think, this person can help me. So this is, you see, this is very, very practical when you think about it, for preaching. And there's a lot of, in the history of ISKCON, there's a lot of examples could be given. You know, a person receiving a book on the street, and they take it home and they read it. Such wonderful philosophy. And they become enamored of it. And then they think, well, I have to go to the place where these people are practicing this philosophy. Where? And they find the address. And then they go there, and then... I don't want to give examples. It's kind of sometimes sad. But sometimes they have a experience other than what they expected. They meet someone who seems to be very passionate and very greedy that they give a donation right now. And, you know, someone who easily becomes angry when they just ask an innocent question. You nonsense, you rascal! Someone who's been in ISKCON for, you know, as long as we have been knows many such stories. And that kind of puts a hamper on our preaching. So it is, for want of anything else to say, we can simply focus on this, that it is a very excellent preaching strategy to develop the qualities universally acknowledged as being philosophical. People will respect you. And it's universal. It's not simply, you know, of course, this is well known in India, but it's not simply an Indian thing. It's all over the world. Someone who's both learned and able to speak very nicely, but also detached, aloof, seems to be serene, peaceful, calm in the midst of all kinds of confusion. That person is attractive to others who are seeking answers to their problems. So this is a very, very, very excellent strategy. I mean, for one, to this is also our, you know, essential Vaishnava quality, actually, to actually have these characteristics. But even just for the sake of appearances and preaching, this is very, very practically useful. So, therefore, this is why I'm saying, I find it in my discussions with people to always, you know, keep the pulse, keep my thumb on the pulse of vairagya, or detachment. You see, when discussing with someone some controversial subject, we should be calm and aloof, speaking very strongly, but at the same time, you see, detached. And they, because they are not in control of their senses, they will be the ones, if anyone's going to get excited, they should be the ones who get all excited, all flustered, furious, and then that just, they defeat themselves in that way, you see. Especially if there's others looking onward on the exchange. They see immediately, oh, he's very serene, peaceful, not getting agitated, and this one is all disturbed. And so they will naturally be in sympathy with the one who appears to be the philosopher. So, in this way, it is very, very practical. Yes.
I have one question. It's a kind of doubt, actually. Can we really benefit, actually, from philosophers, or how we can get any benefit? Like, for example, Greek philosophers, we know that they had very strange behavior sometimes and abominable, you know, they were some of them. Most of them, they were pedophiles and like this, you know. So, there.
some people say that.
Yeah. I know, I just heard it. Yeah. So, can we, how practically we can actually, can we get any, I don't know, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and a very practical question. So, the point of my seminar here today, and for these coming days, is not to inspire you to run to your local library and start pulling off the shelf different books of philosophy. That's not the point. But what I'm trying to do is just help you to see what are the basic issues that all philosophers are concerned with. And we can, in the course of these days, have an overview to see how different philosophers in different places and different times of history have tried to answer these fundamental questions. And then from the light of our Bhagavad philosophy, we can see. This is what Prabhupada did in his... It was very important, you know, when Srila Prabhupada was discussing these Western... Srila Prabhupada took it as very, very important. My godbrother Brahmananda was telling me, because he was involved in this to some extent. He said, where in those days, when Prabhupada was having these discussions with different disciples, whatever was going on, where Prabhupada was traveling, different places, but he would always make time. He would always make time and have them come in with their books and discuss the next philosopher. Prabhupada would reply to it. So Prabhupada considered this very, very important, that we understand the basic issue. Srila Prabhupada did not, you can see from these discussions, not that he was speaking as if he was well-versed in all this academic, you know, details of mundane philosophy. But he was, the basic issues he would isolate and he would address. And he would show where this philosopher was right and where he was wrong.
he always asks, what is his philosophy?
Yes. Yeah, that's another point. Don't deal with the person, deal with the philosophy. So this is what we want to accomplish. We want to just study the basic issues and see what are the Bhagavata answers. And it's very important to know that this whole modern world is running on under a certain philosophy. And it's very helpful to us as preachers to know what that philosophy is, to know how it works. And in this way you can get right to the heart of the matter when you're dealing with persons. And they'll come with their different arguments, their different whatever. And they think, I have a very unique... But nothing is unique, They're all borrowing from some common source, and it's good to know what that is.
Yes. I'm asking this question because, some of my friends, actually one of my friends who was, like, a long time in ISKCON distributing books, and he was temple priest, he's now, going back, and he's studying philosophy like this, and he has some different... And there's quite a few devotees studying, this Mandan philosophy.
This is why I personally like to give this kind of seminar. Not that I consider myself so expert at it, but it's important for us to churn Srila Prabhupada's books, because as we heard this morning, all the answers to any question are there in Srila Prabhupada's books. But our problem is that, first of all, we don't know the questions very often, and then we don't know where the answers are in Prabhupada's books. So it's important. What I try to do is, I'm not trying to present myself as, the be-all and end-all of Gaudiya Vaishnava's philosophy. I'm just hoping that I might serve as a kind of spark plug to get you thinking along these lines. Because we have everything. Prabhupada has given us everything. But this is one thing I wrote several books, and this involved me in reading different books of philosophy in preparing for my writing. And one thing I appreciated about all these different mundane philosophers was that they ask very good questions. This is the thing that I came to appreciate about them. And then I was reflecting. You see, when we come to India, India is the land of Vedic knowledge. So in the Vedic knowledge, we have all the answers to the questions being asked in the West. You see? And oftentimes, just like when we were yesterday at Sri Rangam, one Indian gentleman was coming up to us and saying, you do not have an Indian face, but you are wearing Indian dress. And you are having this tilak and all that. How did this happen? So they're amazed. And they're wondering, why is it that Westerners are taking up this philosophy? I could have been sarcastic and pointed out, you do have an Indian face, but you are wearing the Western dress. So many people in India are going to the Western culture. And yet India is the land of the answers. And I reflected, it's because many, many people here in India, although they have this knowledge, they're not asking those questions. They're not really interested in those questions. And in the West, they have followed... This is also Prabhupada's explanation. They have followed material development to its absurd end, you see? All of their science and research and everything has ended in absurdity. They themselves, they admit it. I was reading an article where one man was saying, in all these new technological... trends come out, we hear all kinds of golden promises, like when the internet came out, when they started promoting the internet. They said, oh, this will help you gain instant knowledge and communication with people all around the world, and scientific understanding will increase, blah, blah, blah. People will become more learned, and, you know, we can do so many things, even government through the internet and everything. Everyone can just vote at home in their... All these, you know, idyllic dreams were promised. And he said, but what is the result? What is the most prominent thing on the internet now, as we see it? Pornography. This is what's really come up. So they, in the West, they realize all this, you know, it's just coming to absurdity. So they're asking why? What is the point? What is the purpose of human life? This is what I appreciate about Western philosophers. They don't have any answers, that's for sure. Or if they try to have answers, they're really rubbish answers. But the questions are very good, and this is important. Manisinam, to be thoughtful. So, you see, we're in ISKCON. And ISKCON is a society of Vedic culture. We received everything from Srila Prabhupada, but we should not take it for granted, you see. Otherwise, the same thing will happen to us. We just think, yeah, all the answers are there on the shelf. We know everything. It's all there, you see. And then the mind becomes dull. Prabhupada warned, don't become dull-headed. Don't become dull-headed. He wanted us to read and discuss threadbare, to have open, you see. What was that? There's a quotation. There should be
different angles
of vision, new lights.
Discussing all the points of philosophy from different angles.
Right.
Of vision.
So.
What often mentioned that?
Yeah, and this is churning this great treasure of knowledge that Prabhupada has given us when we do like that. So this is why I feel that these seminars are important.
Yeah, I am the perpetrator of this. I invited Sahoja Maharaj and all of you to come, so maybe I should give a few words of explanation for this devious activity that we are presently engaged in. Devotee is supposed to be a philosopher, and especially preachers. We're interested in what is the Jacques Charon. It's a parallel of Jivasya Tattva Jignyasa. That life should be... What he's saying is a parallel of the statement that life should be lived for the sake of inquiring into the absolute truth. So, as our commitment to Krishna consciousness has to be on a philosophical basis of understanding the absolute truth. And that means to separate the understanding of what is satya from that which is mithya, or all the other. We're living in a world of philosophies. Everyone has some philosophy, everyone has some angle, and those who are in the course of history, those who are more thoughtful have codified their thoughts into systems of philosophy, and these have, and although most people are not aware of it, the way we think is influenced by centuries of bogus ideas that have been, or some, there may be some truth in it, but they don't quite hit the target. What different philosophers have come up with, as Maharaj was saying, Prabhupada was saying, what is right in someone's philosophy, what is wrong? They may come up with some some right things also. So as preachers, we're supposed to be preachers, and we're meeting people with different ideas, and therefore this philosophy seminar is supposed to go a little deeper into understanding where the ideas which are prominent in the world at present, where they've come from, what is the clear vision of the Bhagavad. It's not that we're just, it's not supposed to be just a comparative philosophy class, like in the Karmi universities, where they just examine all different philosophies and don't come to any conclusion. But rather, we know that everything's there on the shelf, everything is there in Prabhupada's books, but how to bring this philosophy to life in me, because the Bhagavatam itself is is dealing, although we may not be aware of it, but it's dealing with all different philosophies, or it's answering different philosophies, which we may not be aware of that, but many of the verses are actually, they're answering the philosophies of different Sankhya yoga and all these different things. So philosophy is not that we have Bhagavad philosophy and that's it, that's perfect. And for us, maybe that's all right, but then preaching in the world, it's important that we should know philosophy very well. And Prabhupada actually wrote this in one letter, that now some of our devotees should become very expert in philosophy. So it's examining all these different philosophies helps us to understand to appreciate more how the Bhagavad philosophy, Bhagavad Tattva Vijnana, is the Bhagavatam is the answer to all questions. And discussing in the light of all different philosophers who have some, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, some flashes of insight or something like and then separate from their illusions, which come from ultimately from the envy of Krishna. So examining it in the light of all, it helps us to appreciate how great is the Bhagavad philosophy, and helps us to just discussing this philosophy more and more helps us to go more and more deeply into it. And that will help us if we do come across that rare species of person called a philosopher. But even more so, it will help us to appreciate philosophy so more and more deeply, so that even when we say what may appear to be a very simple statement, there'll be so much depth of realization there that people will be impressed. Now, when I say impressed, I don't mean just intellectually, but they'll appreciate that we have some very deep realizations.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Could you kind of comment on this reflection I had when you spoke about the dichotomy between the how questioners and the why questioners? And I remember there was a conversation with Prabhupada with a philosopher in Mexico. I think he was a German guy. Mm-hmm. I think I read in your Vyasa Puja offering one year.
Yes.
Okay. So in that conversation, he was saying, if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, why is there anything?
Why is there anything?
Yeah. And then Prabhupada kind of chuckled and said, well, actually, the question is, where does everything come from?
Yes.
Could you comment, please?
Yes, because the answer to why, or also how, ultimately, is found in the origin. This is the principle of design. You see, that if we see in something that there is a design, a purpose, a purposeful, you see, system, then we have to look to the designer, the intelligence that has wrought this thing. So, philosophers and scientists, they study this world.
Could you say that again? In order to understand the why of something, then you have to study the designer.
Yes.
I get it?
Yeah. Prabhupada gave an example. There was a book called Shah Jahan. A novel or a play, I think it was a play, a drama. I've forgotten the author, a Bengali author, I believe. And it was about this Mughal emperor, Shah Jahan. And his youngest son was Aurangzeb. So the drama seems to follow Aurangzeb, all the horrible things he did in this history, the heir apparent, there was the oldest son was supposed to become the Badshah after Shah Jahan, but Aurangzeb, he cut off his oldest brother's head and presented it to his father Shah Jahan in a nice ornate box as a present. And father, I have a gift for you. And then his father opened up that head of his oldest son, just to show that, you know, Aurangzeb was showing, I'm going to take over the throne, not him or anyone else. So anyway, the action of the drama seemed to follow Aurangzeb, all the different dirty dealings he was doing. And so the question was asked, then why is this drama called Shah Jahan? Because Shah Jahan had simply been imprisoned by Aurangzeb. And Aurangzeb was doing all the action. And Shah Jahan was just sitting in prison. So, and then Prabhupada explained that persons who were wondering about this, they went to the author of this book, Shah Jahan, this drama, and asked him. And he said, well, what I wanted to do was to get the viewer, the reader, the attendee of the drama, to sympathize with Shah Jahan. He's sitting in prison, and all these things that Aurangzeb is doing are striking on his heart. Every stage of the action, Shah Jahan is hearing about, now he's, you know, killed another brother or done this or done that. And it is striking him in the heart. And so in this way, he wanted the audience's sympathy to go to Shah Jahan, even though Shah Jahan, in terms of action, was a minor character. And that's why he named it. So Prabhupada said, if you want to know then, why was this named Shah Jahan, you have to go to the author. So if you want to know the how and why of this world, you have to go to the author of the world, which is Krishna. So this is called this is a philosophical principle of design. The argument from design is called. That if you can see in this world a system, a purpose, you see evidence of, you see a chain of cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, then this means intelligence. And so then one has to inquire about that intelligent person who has brought all this about. It's just like the Greek philosopher Plato. He said something very intelligent. He said this. He said, in my body, because the Greeks, they understood four elements, four of the five Mahabhutas they understood. So earth, water, fire, air. And actually they understood the fifth they called the quintessence, the fifth essence. But that was something very mystical and spiritual. You know, ether for them was a real transcendental conception. But they were more sure about the first four. So anyway, he was saying, in my body, there's earth. And in the great universe, there's earth in vast and limited quantities. And the same with water, and the same with fire, and the same with air. So another thing that's in my body is intelligence. So why shouldn't there be a vast, cosmic, supreme intelligence, which is the guiding principle of everything in this world? It's only logical. This was his argument. This is called the argument from design. So that, yes, this was... And you see in that discussion with the... There was a Mexican professor and a German man. There were two together. And they were... Whenever Prabhupada came to this point, they were dismissive. They were biased against... No, well, all right. One can say that, but... So they simply wanted to have a nice speculative discussion with Srila Prabhupada. They wanted to set the rules that we won't, let's not talk about the supreme designer, higher superior intelligence from which everything is coming. Let's just look at things here and talk about, speculate about why they are. That was the platform they wanted to discuss, and Prabhupada wouldn't have anything to do with it. Because this is just passing the time, blah, blah, blah. This is what they like to do, the mundane philosophers. Like to just go on blah, 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 hearing themselves talk. And, maybe, Prabhupada used to saturate, maybe like this, maybe like that. And it comes to no conclusion, so it's useless. Croaking of frogs. Therefore, atattu brahma jignasa. Therefore, this is real philosophy. And now we should inquire into Brahman. And Brahman, the root is brim, which means that from which everything grows and develops. So that source of development for everything, that is Brahman, the source of everything. So atattu brahma jignasa, we should inquire into that which is the source of everything. That is the meaning. Yes.
Maharaj, sometimes in preaching we got some arguments from modern philosophers and from professor of philosophy, so I tried to explain how actually all the philosophers were perfect. Even Pythagoras were more thoughtful than nowadays philosophers. So I told him Vedic concept is actually absolute truth, is pure, is perfect. So he argued, if it's perfect, why doesn't everything collapse? Why you are bringing all these old things? You see, everything is collapsing. If it's perfect, then it should stay perfect. Why everything is degraded? So then I started to give some arguments, like explaining Satya Treta Dvaparakali and some arguments. But can you give us some good arguments how to explain actually this?
I come right back to my point of Vairagya. You see, this real philosophy equips one to become detached from this world. Your professor is revealing in that argument his attachment to this world. He's attached, he wants things to, you know, and that's all right if one understands transcendence, if one understands the real nature of transcendence. That there is, also in Western philosophy, the Platonic idea of, you know, the world of eternal forms. So anyway, that there is, that reality is beyond this world of matter. And knowledge, real knowledge, means to raise one's consciousness to that level of reality. And then one is naturally detached from the ever-changing forms and features of this material world. For someone who argues like that, you see, it's childish, it's foolishness. It's attachment philosophy.
Because he accepts, he can understand Sanskrit, he can understand one line of Vedanta. So I told him, how can you then reject it? How can you say that this is primitive and foolish? You can't even understand, even you can't even read it now. What about understanding? So you must understand it's higher. No, it's all because everything collapsed. Actually,
that's the nature of this world. That's the first thing he has to understand.
What does he mean to say that? Because in India, the whole culture collapsed.
Yeah, he said because if philosophy
is quite wrong. But that's the nature of the world. The European culture is collapsing right now. Western is busy collapsing right now. And will soon be no more.
Problem is, we have this impression due to this brainwashing that we are progressing. So there's always that crazy idea that we are progressing. So to say something was perfect, actually, how can collapse?
Yeah. It is collapsing right now. And the main thing is he will collapse. You see, that's this nice definition here. The totality of death. And you know, this is by transference. See, this is the same stupid strategy. He's trying to transfer. But no, sir, you are going to die. Your life in that body is going to collapse. What are you going to do about it? So this is what philosophy has meant. Yes, this whole world is going to collapse. Everything. We are everything. And philosophy is supposed to equip us so that we can get out of this collapsible trap of material existence. Yes?
Maharaj, Prabhupada famous comment is religion and philosophy relations.
Please speak more loudly and clearly.
Prabhupada's comment about religion and philosophy relationship. Religion without philosophy is a sentiment. Philosophy without religion is mental speculation.
Yes.
Can further explain on that? Because we are philosophizing the religion, I think.
Yeah, well, okay. I go back to this point about the asking of questions. So religion, dharma. So India is the land of dharma. And you see, Indian people, even today, they're very attached to their rituals, going to temple, going to take darshan of someone they think is a god. You see. But it is blind. You see, this is simply sentiment. They don't really know what questions to ask to begin with. And because they don't know what questions to ask of a saintly person, therefore they don't know what a saintly person is. They're not going to so-called saintly person to ask the right questions to get the right answers. They're going, you know, to for some mystic jugglery, for some false assurances, never fear, I am here, and all that sort of thing. And therefore they're cheated. You see? And then on the other side, philosophy without religion is just mental speculation. They ask the questions, like in this book by Jacques Charon. I read one sentence, but there are other things, like I said, some things are right, some things are wrong. So he's a very pessimistic person. And you see that the theme of his book is that there actually is no answer to the problem of death. He's saying this is what philosophy is about, and we should face death and we should inquire into the meaning of life, but ultimately we'll all be annihilated by death and that's it. You know, this seems to be the general trend of his thinking. So then what is left? Just mental speculation, you see. It's hopeless. Mental speculation means hopeless. You have your idea, I have my idea, yeah, you can talk, I can talk. But, you know, the big foot is going to come down and squash us all, and that's the end of it.
So, and therefore, hedonism.
Yes, hedonism.
There's nothing left.
Yeah. In the West, that's all they have left, is their sense gratification.
Religion without philosophy only related with Indian thoughts, or it is in the West also?
Well, you know, West established religion is pretty much a memory now. People talk about, oh, remember when we used to go to church every Sunday? And then there's a new age where they're trying to, you know, cook up in the laboratory of mental speculation some, you know, new type of religion. But that's a joke. They say there are five kinds of miseries. Have you heard this? Birth, death, disease, old age, and new age. Doesn't solve any problem. It's just another misery. So, anyway, West is pretty much, but West is open to something new, and that is Krishna consciousness. So, yeah, the two have to be combined. Which basically means, as we've been saying, that there are the essential questions, tattva jignyasa, that must be asked. And we find those answers in Dharma, in Bhagavad Dharma. I remember in 1972, September, Srila Prabhupada came to Mool Vrindavan, and for 1 week he gave Bhagavad Dharma discourses. And this was the whole theme. This was the essential theme. It was Dharma, religion, but religion which answered the essential questions of life and therefore solved the essential problems of life. And that is the Bhagavad Dharma, the religion of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes?
Want to ask a question?
Okay.
You told that basically, it's appeared to be that materialistic philosophy would be coming towards Buddhism. And I came across some statement of Madhvacharya. He tell him that Buddha, he spoke his philosophy to different people. First he talked to some materialist demons and they become like a Buddhist. So then he went to demigods. And when they learned it, it appeared to be for the most pure tattva, theistic religion. So question, is it a person having inside himself already some conception in which way he liked to accept some teaching?
Yeah, that's a good point. I was actually thinking of that this morning when I was
hearing Yogendra Prabhu's class, that was coming into my mind. And I alluded to it in the comment I made, how the demons and the demigods both learned from Brahma, but they came to opposite conclusions. So
that's similar to the Virochana and Indra.
Yes. That's in the Upanishads.
Yeah.
That's another story. Lord Brahma, they came, Virochana, the king of the demons, and Indra, the king of the demigods, came before Brahma to learn Atma-tattva, knowledge of the self. So to test them, Lord Brahma, he showed them a dish with water. And he said, what you see in this, that is the self. So they looked and they saw their own, just the faces, you know, reflection of the faces of the body. So Virochana went back. He was very happy. He said, I know Atma-jnana, I know Atma-tattva. It's a very simple thing. We always knew it here in the Asura look. And Indra also went back, but when he started, he also tried to teach it to the devatas, but they were all like, no. And then he didn't feel good about, something's wrong. So he went back. And then Brahma told him, yeah, I was just testing to see who is really qualified to become my disciple. So you're the one who came back, so you'll be my disciple. And the real Atma-gyan. And the other one, Virochana, he was happy. He didn't come back. So, yes, there is this question, I think, of this motivation. And this is what separates the devotees from the demons. The demons may also take to Vedic knowledge, but they always use it for their own ends, materialistic ends. So that's one thing, and then this clear separation. Srila Jiva Goswami, he says that there are those who are, what's the word? Incurable.
Achikitsa.
Yeah. When they may come into sadhu sangha and gain some knowledge, but this knowledge makes them arrogant. You see? And this is the same example with the snake and the milk. The snake drinks the milk, but it increases his poison. So he calls these fellows incurable. Even they get a sadhu sangha, it doesn't help them. And that's because they're aparadi, they're offenders. So I think this is the basic line of demarcation. On one side there are offenders. They're so offensive that even when they get good association, even when they get the holy name, they spoil it. Then on the other side, there are those who are not offensive. Now, in that category, there are also possible different points of view. The example of the Vaidurya stone, the Vaidurya gem, a jewel, which when you look at it from this side, it's green. From when you look at it this side, it's red. One sees it red, one sees it green, one sees it blue, one sees it yellow. So these are the different glories of this one gem. So it's possible among Vaishnavas there are different sampradayas. Some are worshipping the Lord as Radha and Krishna, some as Lakshmi Narayan. So some as Lord Ramachandra. So the Prabhupada said it's not that one is right and the other is wrong, but they're realizing the Lord with their particular devotional flavor, and that's fine. You see, the point is that in this there's no offense. So there is variety in devotional sentiment. But when there's the real demarcation is where there's offense. Is that clear?
exchange is going on. Honestly, for them it is difficult to step over this. For them difficult to step over this own inherent nature.
Yes, it is, therefore they're called incurable. It is difficult. Yes.
Yeah, in which sense Mayavadi is
colored?
In which sense that shloka from Padma Purana, Mayavadi is a colored Buddhism?
Well, that's interesting.
Because seemingly that Mayavadi accept the reality of Buddhism is shunya. So
I'll answer. This type of question kind of takes us ahead. This is something we could talk later on, but it's so interesting, I'll answer it now, since you asked this question. Pachanam Baudam, covered Buddhism. So, the essence of Buddhism is faithlessness towards the Vedic scriptures. The Lord Buddha, in his teachings, he taught this principle, avyakritta vastuni, that there are things that cannot be expressed in words. And in Buddhist philosophy, these are 10 items, famously 10 items. And when you see these 10 items, it's like then you wonder, well, if you can't talk about these 10 things, then what question, is there of any philosophy whatsoever? It's like, is there a soul or is there not? Is the soul eternal? Is there a God? Is there not a God? Is the universe eternal or temporary? All these things Buddha said, we cannot talk about. He wouldn't discuss whenever asked about these things. So, therefore, the Buddhists, you know, they have this kind of mauna mysticism when it comes to paramartika things beyond, then you cannot talk about them. And this is their basic objection to Vedic knowledge, is that Vedic knowledge talks about it. Vedic mantras is expressing so many things which for Buddhism cannot be put into words. So they don't have faith in the Vedic knowledge. And you know why, because Lord Buddha decried the Vedas because they were being misused for animal slaughter. He said, never mind the Vedas, they're just invented by human beings, stuck referring to them. So the Buddhists are faithless in this respect. So now, Mayavadi philosophy, Shankaracharya, also comes to the same point. They just have a different word. Anirvachaniya. It means the same thing, something that can't be discussed. So Maya is anirvachaniya and Brahman is anirvachaniya. So these are the only two subjects that you'll hear Mayavadis talk about. And then ultimately, these are things that you can't talk about. So all this talking that goes on, and Mayavadi philosophy being spoken, here I'll give you some terms. Mediate and immediate. Immediate. You know, immediate means without any media in between. When you experience something immediately, you're there. Mediate means you are hearing about it. It's like you get a phone call and a friend says, oh, I just had a wonderful time here at such and such place. We had a nice big pizza. It was really delicious. You've never had a pizza like this. So you hear about it and you get some idea of what it was like, but of course you don't immediately experience it. So this is immediate knowledge. So for the Mayavadis, even their own philosophy, their big Shankaracharya sitting on his seat, Kanchipuram Shankara speaking away, this is all mediate. He's talking about something else. But his talk is not that something else. You see, even the Vedas, even the Upanishads, even the Vedanta Sutra, this is all mediate. It's about something else. which is not immediately present in those words. So therefore the Mayavadis too, they say you have to go beyond words. You have to go beyond words, you have to go beyond form. Yeah. And so the absolute truth is something, again, inexpressible. You can't speak about it, you can't even think about it. You can't ever show it to anyone else in any way. So then what is it? Well,
that's like a question.
See, and that's why it all comes down. It's so bogus, you know. It all comes down to someone, you know, with a weird glint in his eye, staring off. And, oh, he must know. Because he's looking off into space. He's not making any sound. He's just
spiritual.
And this is golden opportunity for so much cheating. Therefore, Prabhupada says, a fool, when he's silent, he can pass for a sage, as long as he remains silent. As soon as he opens his mouth, everybody knows he's a fool. So therefore, they don't talk. Because it's foolish philosophy. Foolosophy. So that's what they have in common.
That's the question asked by Parikshit in the prayers by personified beings.
Whether the absolute truth can be expressed in words. Yes. Yes, that's the essence. Both Buddhists and Mayavadis say no.
They ignore the question. They ignore the question.
Yes.
And they ignore the question, and then they say, well, it's the ultimate is Gyan, but that Gyan can't be expressed in knowledge, therefore it's just something to be experienced. So it's just a big bluff. They bluff that they're experiencing it.
Yes, exactly. Because the immediate experience, what is it? Where is it? Who has it? That can't be answered. So then that's immediately opening the barn door for all kinds of cheating. Because there's no standard at all. You see? And you see this in India, you know, they swallow anything. Anything. Osho. I mean, what a total nonsense. But you see his books in every train station bookstall. Osho books. Total nonsense. That's because actually they don't know. That's the point. They don't know. They don't have any knowledge whatsoever. It's all bluff.
Question. You said that every materialistic philosophy ends in a paradox, but there's a very basic question of Krishna consciousness which people often ask us, and you are a major contributor to that book, our original position. Yeah. The paradox of the origin of the jiva. That's why I said you might clap your hand to your head. Now, if we say that the jiva was originally with Krishna, then the question comes then, if we're in perfect knowledge, then why did we, if we're experiencing that bliss, then why should we ever give it up? On the other hand, if we say that we started off in a neutral kind of position, or we're just here eternally, then it would appear that God is unfair, because he allows some jivas to be with him and some jivas he just leaves them here. So they're just here. So there appears to be a paradox in this basic question of jiva tattva.
I think what I'll do is, because that very subject I was planning to get into by way of explaining because we're talking about truth and how to realize the truth, and in order to do that, then we have to become purified.
And so then that brings in the whole question of how we got in this state and how do we get out of it. And so I was going to spend several days on that.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And go into that in quite great detail from the Bhagavatam. But Maharaj has asked this question, so we cannot just...
No, I can wait for the days.
No, I can give, let's say, a sutra, yeah. and then you'll know what will be elaborated on in the days to come. So, Mama Ayvansa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Krishna says, the jivas are my eternal parts and parcels. He says clearly, Sanatana. So, it is not that once we were with Krishna and now we are not. We are with Krishna right now. And in that verse in the Taittiriya Upanishad, Raso Vaisaha, it is also stated that that rasa, which is he, is also fueling the materialistic activities of the living entities who are in illusion. They are doing their work with their senses and their pranas also because of that rasa. And so this means that we are with Krishna and we are experiencing rasa right now. But something has gone amiss, you see, with us. And that is that we have become attracted to the external features of the Lord's energy. It's the Lord's energy is one, but it has internal and external features. Like Prabhupada said when he initiated our god sister Mahamaya Devi Dasi, everyone was shocked who was attending that initiation. Why would this Mataji get that name? Mahamaya. And Prabhupada, he could sense, you know, that there was some bewilderment. And he smiled and said, Mahamaya is another, that depends on how you hear what Prabhupada said. Either he said phase of Radharani or face of Radharani. But either way, it's the same thing. That he was saying Mahamaya is simply another feature of Srimati Radharani, the internal potency. So external potency means internal potency acting as external potency. You see? So we're in this all in this same position. But because why? Bahirmukh. Jiva Bahirmukahan, Bhogavanchakari. We have become interested in sense gratification, in enjoying the Lord's energies, rather than serving the Lord and his energies, being within his energy as servants. We have decided to try to be the Lord ourselves. It's just a change in our own attitude. Otherwise, our position is the same. Everything's the same. But the effect is differently, and that's different, and that's the example of electricity, either heating or cooling. So that's how I answer this question. I think it is, you know, misleading, this consideration of the fault. Once we were with and now we are not, we fell down and we are somewhere else. And that's what I want to discuss in the next days, the Bhagavatam explanation of the situation of the jiva, because we have to understand this. We have to how to clarify our consciousness in order to have the darshan of the absolute truth. So we'll go into that in very great detail. I kid you not, because this is one thing I have been doing seminars on several times. So I'm quite prepared. This is what we call Vedic psychology. It's the Vedic explanation of the psychology, of the workings within the consciousness of the living entity. And psychology also has that sense of healing aberrations in consciousness and thinking. So this is will be an elaborate subject. But that is in days to come.
There's a clock here.
12:15.
Okay. So we didn't want to go beyond 12:30. Is there anything else?
Actually, there was a sequel to that
reply that you gave me about the cause, you know, the philosophy of the desire, and then the cause, this leads naturally to the question of the cause, right? But in the Chaitanya Charitamrita in regard to Advaita, there's a very elaborate philosophical discussion regarding two different kinds of causes, as I recall. One was the efficient, and the other was the material, if I remember correctly. Right?
There are four kinds of causes.
Exactly. That was the point. Because I remember Ravindra Sarup Prabhu was speaking on Advaita Charya's appearance day, and he was saying something about the Greeks having four.
It's not the Greeks. It's the Bhagavatam.
Oh, really?
Yes. We can discuss that.
That will come
There's
up.
A verse in which all four of these causes are given with their Sanskrit terminology.
Just how come.
And then you see it also appears in Greek philosophy much later.
Okay.
And they get all the credit for it, as you do. Just like Vedic astrology appears and astronomy appears later in Greek culture. And everyone says the Greeks, they invented astrology and astronomy. Anything else? Yes.
It's possible that we in Kali Yuga establish Vedic culture and Parishana Dharma.
Is that your question? Is it possible?
That we establish in Kali Yuga Vedic culture and Parishana Dharma.
You're asking simply, is it possible? My answer is yes, it's possible. It's not much of a question, and therefore it's not much of an answer.
How can we start?
Huh?
How can we start in practical life with this possibility?
How can we start? You can start by living in the Hare Krishna temple, getting up in the morning, attending Mangal Arati, chanting 16 rounds, hearing Bhagavatam class, taking Krishna Prasadam, going out on Harinam, Sankirtan, distributing Srila Prabhupada's books, inviting people back to the temple, preaching to them, getting them interested in our philosophy and practice. In this way, enlisting more and more congregation, and out of the congregation, making more and more devotees, making an impact on society. Because Varnashram Dharma, who creates Varnashram Dharma? Chaturvarna Maya Shristam. Krishna says, I do it. He doesn't say Chaturvarnam Grihastha Council Shristam. He doesn't say Chaturvarnam GBC Shristam. He doesn't say any of that. He says, I do it. So all we have to do is become Krishna conscious and help others in the service of our spiritual master become Krishna conscious. And when there are enough Krishna conscious persons, enough devotees who want to live a life that satisfies Krishna, live a life of devotional service to Krishna in this world, in this present world, do you think Krishna is just going to let them struggle in the midst of this barbaric Kali Yuga type of society? Just struggle, you know, trying to get on in this barbaric economy and barbaric atmosphere, sinfulness? No. Krishna will step in. Just like Krishna sent Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada is the real Brahmana. The real Brahmana preacher. So then the next stage, next stage of Varnashram Dharma, we need a real Kshatriya. I don't think a real Kshatriya we can elect, or, you know, not by votes, or, you know, not by having courses, and Krishna has to send such a person. I'm sure that he will. So we have our duty given to us by Srila Prabhupada. It's very clear. It's very simple also, but it's a great challenge. Great challenge to each and every one of us to execute what Prabhupada has given us to do properly. And I have full confidence if we do what Prabhupada wants us to, what he told us to do, those things, then Varna Ashram Dharma will manifest. As
a natural progression of Lord Krishna's, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission in this world. I don't think we have to resort to, you know, some type of speculation, some type of desperate muddling here and there to try to artificially create Varnashram Dharma. This is Lord Krishna's system, and he says, I create it. And why shouldn't he do it? You see, I really think it's a question of faith. We surrender ourselves to Krishna, we give everything to him, we try to serve him only. You don't think he's not going to reciprocate? For the furtherance of this movement, to every town and every village, fulfilling Lord Chaitanya's prophecy. So many cows are being slaughtered in this world today. You don't think that won't stop? You think that's just going to go on? More and more McDonald's. I heard they opened McDonald's in Rajamandal now.
Oh, God. In Mathura, it has been for 2 years.
In Mathura. Krishna will stop this, have no doubt. We have our part to play, serving him, fulfilling this mission that Prabhupada has given us. Some Kshatriya has to come, there's no doubt about that. Real powerful personality. Not someone who's elected by votes, not someone who does things by, you know, vox populi agreement, but he has actually the power with his own arms, his own abilities, his own strength to take command. And this power is given by Krishna because he's like Maharaj Yudhisthira, like Arjuna, like Maharaj Pariksit. 100% servant of Krishna. Yes?
Maharaj, you said that out of the two ways of gaining knowledge, Aroha and Avroha, in Aroha, we also need to qualify to receive the knowledge. I was just talking to a Christian while coming. He said that actually, Jesus Christ, he doesn't ask for any qualification. That is the specialty of Christianity. But your movement means you have to do something. But our Jesus, he doesn't ask for any qualification. And the similar thing we read in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's, like, he didn't put the condition that first you surrender and then you will get my mercy. Rather, he didn't see for the qualification. So how to put this thing?
First of all, that Christian's argument is totally bogus. Even from the standpoint of Christianity itself, it's not acceptable. Because Jesus Christ, he said in the New Testament, those who love me will follow me. So we find in the New Testament, just referring to New Testament now for a few seconds, just to establish this point. There's the story of the rich young man who wanted to become a disciple of Christ. And so he approached him very humbly and said, I want to follow you. I want to become your disciple, learn from you, as your other disciples are doing. And Jesus said, very nice, you can do it. He said, but you take all of your wealth and you distribute it to the poor. Give up all your wealth, give it all to the poor, and come to me just simple cloth, barefoot. Jesus Christ, he was a sannyasi. He just moved around village to village, here and there, sometimes sleeping in fields, sometimes under a tree, just preaching. And this is how he taught his disciples. Just to travel, preach, be totally detached. So he gave this instruction to this young man, and he became very pale in his face. He left. And Christ commented that it is more difficult for a rich man to enter heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. So it's not that Jesus didn't ask anything. Jesus Christ was a sannyasi, and he was asking those if you love me, you will follow me. In other words, you will come with me as you know, sannyasi disciple of myself. Brahmachari, sannyasi disciples. This is what he asked. So, and has been much discussed in the history of the church at this point. And none of the church theologians have ever come to that conclusion that one just does nothing. There's another statement in the Bible, faith without works is dead. Someone said, I believe in Christ. But if you have nothing to show in your life, then that's a dead faith. So, you know, just from the Christian, within that circle of reference, you can see that. I've heard these Christians, they talk like, but that's just bogus, it's just their propaganda that they make. And they themselves, even they are saying it, they know it's not true. They just say that to people to enlist them, and then after they're, you know, securely, they think they're securely in the camp of Christianity, then they start telling, well, now you should do this, you should do that. To be a good Christian, you have to do so many things. First they say, you don't have to do anything. So this is just a line they give. It's not true. And as far as the point of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu being Patita Pavan, yes, but as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to say, that Vaishnava Sharalata Ata. The Vaishnava is one who is simple. And there is one song that says, that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda, they are Patita Pavan. And so they have come to deliver the fallen. But still, in that category of fallen, they are those who are Sharalata, those who are simple. And that means those who are simply admitting, yes, I am fallen. And so they take to this Krishna consciousness, they take to the Sankirtan given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then there is an opposite word, is it? Kapatya?
Kapat.
Kapat.
Yeah. Kapat means
crooked.
Crooked.
Yes. So there's an opposite word to Sharalata, to be crooked. And so this song that they never, Mahaprabhu and Nityananda, they never deliver those who are crooked. Because those who are crooked disqualify themselves. They put themselves in a situation where even their mercy, which is meant for all those who are patita, it cannot touch them because they're so crooked. Therefore, Prabhupada said, it's simple for the simple, but very difficult for those who are crooked. So you see, there is this qualification. It's such a simple qualification. Be simple. Another simple qualification. Be simple. Be straightforward. Be honest. If one is fallen, one should say, I'm fallen. And therefore, I'm in need of mercy. This is the prayer of Narottam Das Thakur. You'll not find a person more fallen than myself. Therefore, my claim to your mercy is first. That's the meaning. One should... But the crooked person, as we were talking before, those who are incurable, they get touched with a little mercy and immediately suddenly they are Mahant, they are Acharya, they are this, they are that. You know, they are... I remember we were discussing about years ago about Apashampradayas, and you were telling me about... Maharaj was telling me about in Bangladesh, and one moves up, one starts as a brahmachari preacher and gets some success. And then the followers from different villages, they come to him one day and say, we think now you've become so successful that you should declare yourself now an avatar. It's not good enough that you're only this brahmachari creature. Now you can claim your avatar. So, in this way, he moves upwards. And they also move upward. Because then they become eternal associates of the avatar. And they are also avatars.
You don't want to be outdone by the others.
Yeah. Keep up, because there are so many other avatars, you see. So you have to keep up. So this is how it goes among these upper sampradayas.
And this is crooked. This is not simple. Therefore, they disqualify themselves from the mercy, even though they're chanting, they're doing everything, but they spoil it, and thus their standard of sadhana degrades in so many ways. So many impurities infiltrate in. Because they think they're avatars, therefore they think they can do anything. Eat fish again with tulsi leaves on it and all this kind of thing. Take bidi, do any nonsense thing. All in the name of Leela. And so everything is spoiled. So yes, it's no special qualification is there. But one can still become disqualified. That's the point. Lord Chaitanya is just asking us to chant Hare Krishna. Don't even surrender. This is that point in the discussion with Ramananda Roy, when Ramananda Roy was proposing different measures to Mahaprabhu. I think the third one was Sarva Dharma Parityaja Mamekam. And Mahaprabhu said, Eho Bhaya, this is external. Sarva Dharma Parityaja. And he... And Prabhupada explained, because that is also, you know, someone, actually one of our god brothers, I won't mention him, but he's also from Tamil Nadu. And he told me how he became frustrated in his life. He was working in TVS, and he became very frustrated, so he went to Srinivas in, what is it, Trivandrum?
Tirupati.
Sorry. Yeah. And there he took sannyas. He bathed in that Swami Pushkarini and came before the deity, and he changed his cloth, and he was remembering Sarva Dhamma and Parityajama. And Prabhupada explained, just like he said, that yeah, they do like that. But it's just a concoction. Even though Krishna is there, Lord Venkateshwar is there, you've taken the bath in the holy place, you've changed your cloth to saffron. But it's still a concoction. It's still just external. And therefore Mahaprabhu rejected that. It's not the real meaning of surrender. So even that, so Lord Chaitanya is not asking us to surrender. He's not asking you to change your cloth, to, you know, stand before some deity and take some bombastic vow or anything like that. Just chant Hare Krishna and be simple. Be honest, be straightforward, serve the devotees, humbly try to make advancement by accepting this process sincerely at heart.
Then he was describing some unusual experiences he just had when he came before Jesus. So it's the same category that when we talk about something which cannot be talked about, something which cannot be, so it makes it open to everything, whatever one experienced, to be named as spiritual?
Well, off the record, I don't like these comments to go on tape. But, and I have it confirmed because I have preached a few times in Maharashtra, in Kolhapur. And there's a bhakta there who was... He was born in Muslim family and then he became Christian, and now he's becoming Hare Krishna. He's a very nice, sincere person. But he also told me his experience, especially his conversion to Christianity. And the experiences they get. And I told him, you know, because he wanted me to comment, I said, you know, in so many tamasic religions, because in Christianity, the symptoms of tamaguna are so prominent. The meat eating, the wine drinking. So in these kind of tamasic religions, there is intercourse, there is interaction with ghosts. You know, in voodoo, this African religion, in your tantra, tamasic tantra in India, they're having congress with ghosts. And then there are so many strange things happen, inside and outside. And these are, Prabhupada says, and these are taken as spiritual experiences. Oh, this is no different. These people, if you look at their life, habits. They're very dark, you know, very down in the mode of darkness. So yes, strange things may be happening, but it is ghostly. I'm just telling you this because you're asking. This is not, one has to be very careful saying this out to outsiders, you see, but it's a fact.
In one of my interviews about the about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said Jyoti Shekhar Prabhu, who told me so many things, he said that one man once came to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and said, I saw Krishna yesterday sitting on the side of the river. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said to him that if you actually saw Krishna, then you wouldn't still be looking towards Maya. He said, you must have seen, Jyoti Shekhar Prabhu said that, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that, you must have seen a ghost.
Yeah.
And that's well known that sometimes ghosts, they come as eminent spiritual personalities,
yes,
and mislead people. They're very, that's one of their favorite tricks.
There's one well-known story also in Vrindavan. One person was, he'd come to Vrindavan and he was staying in a dharamshala. And he wanted to go out and do parikram and take darshan with different important temples. And so the proprietor of the dharamshala said, yes, he gave him directions how to go. But he told him when he was going one place he would go, he said, you'd be very careful on this path. It was to some temple. And he said, don't be diverted from this path I'm telling you. It's very bad influences along that way. So he was thinking, okay, and he went. He went to the temple, then on the way back, there was a lane going off the main path he was told to take, some lane, and he heard kirtan coming from that lane. And it sounded so sweet. So he left the path and he went down that lane. And then he came to what looked to him like a party of traveling devotees, you know, on pilgrimage. And they had their encampment and they were having kirtan and they were cooking prasad and everything. And they invited him. And so he came among them and they wanted him to stay with them. You can stay with us. No, but I'm in the dharamshala and the others are there, so I have to go back. All right, but at least take some prasad. Well, I don't have time, they're expecting me back. Then they rolled it in a leaf plate and gave to him. And he took with him and returned. And he was thinking, this proprietor gave me this warning not to go off, but they were such nice devotees and they gave me prasad. So he sat down and unrolled it, and it was stool rolled up. And then the proprietor told him, I told you, there are ghosts there, and they do these kind of things. Yeah, so they can appear as Krishna, as devotees. All right, so we're a little bit over time. So on that note, not such a auspicious note, unfortunately.
Well, everything that's not Krishna conscious is just stool.
Okay. Sorry, Mara. He's expected this is
tell us sometime about the stool of chorus. We quote that sometime. Your analysis of stool of chorus. The sunbathers.
Oh, save that for later. I said I forgot that. Now you remember me. So long ago. Okay. So thank you very much. So we will continue tomorrow. Same time, same place. 10 o'clock, right here. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Hare Krishna.